The Tom Woods Show, episode 2243.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Hope you had a nice Thanksgiving. Very glad to be joined by our friend Dave Benner, who I think is making his very first appearance on the Tom Woods Show. And he is the author of a brand new biography of the very, very interesting historical figure, Thomas Paine. The book is Thomas Paine, A Lifetime of Radicalism. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on the show. This is an absolute honor.
Well, I'm thrilled to talk to you. First of all, this is a massive undertaking, and it must have been a labor of love. I can't help asking a kind of meta question, which is, what led you to do it? Why Thomas Paine?
Yeah, well, there's so many interesting things in Paine's life, so many interesting avenues and facets and places he was around the globe making headway in many different areas. And you know what? I feel like some of the existing historiography of the Paine works out there, you know, falls short of telling the whole tale in some regards, especially in regards to some of his most radical political beliefs, his beliefs on religion, things like that. And also because there hasn't been really a great Paine biography released for the last, you know, several decades. There are several good ones, but none of them put everything together in a way that I think emphasizes the ideas. So it was a four-year labor of love, but I'm proud to say that it's coming to a close and I hope to get it out.
Did you read the Eric Foner book on Thomas Paine?
Yeah, Foner's work is, I've read his book on it, but Foner's work is better for, I believe, the actual writings. He compiled the writings in a two-volume in which I've read every single writing, I hate to say. I'm a masochist, I suppose. But yeah, Foner did great work on Paine. And though, you know, Foner would have different beliefs than us on some things, he made some good contributions to the historiography.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That even though I don't really care for Foner, and I know I'm completely the opposite of him politically, I thought he did a pretty good job with Paine. Not as good as Dave Benner, however, because it is better to have somebody with the, you know, the right worldview and stuff. Now, early on in your book, you make clear that this is not intended to be a day-by-day overview of all the events and features of his life. It's more a study in the ideas and how they unfolded through history. And I was glad to see that because that's exactly the kind of history I like personally. And I'm not saying that people who are different from me are stupid or anything. It's fine. We all have different interests. But I, for example, I just don't care about what kind of shoes did they wear in the 17th century or what hat was in fashion in 1850. None of that holds any interest for me whatsoever. Sometimes family members will say, like, we'll be traveling and they'll say, oh, you should go to the Cowboy Museum. And I'd say, oh my gosh, I would hate every second of that. And they wouldn't understand why. And it's because I'm more interested in like the ideas. I'm interested in the ideas behind, like I'm interested in Marxism. I'm interested in liberalism. I'm interested in these sorts of things. I just don't care about what boot somebody wore. It doesn't do anything for me. But that's okay. I know that is what other people love about history. And if it gets them into history, then that's wonderful. But for Paine, I too am interested in the history of his ideas. But let's start, nevertheless, with a little bit of his background, particularly his upbringing.
Yeah, let's do that. So he was born in a town in Eastern England, kind of small village called Thetford. Grew up under the tutelage of a father that was a staymaker. So as a staymaker, he actually built the structural underpinnings of women's corsets. And let me tell you, some of his political adversaries would make fun of him for that. But, you know, he was essentially raised as a Quaker. His mother, there's little we know of her, but she was an Anglican, but Paine was raised as a Quaker. He had many different interesting jobs as a young man. He was ironically once a tax collector, and he would be involved in what many people consider the most infamous tax revolt in human history, that being the American Revolution. Although I don't think that properly conceptualizes that, he was a tax collector nonetheless. He was also a privateer. So in my book, I write that, you know, he was a privateer that served the interests of Britain, the government he later condemned, his native government, in pillaging French ships, the nation he once helped nurture later. So that was an ironic facet. He also spent some time trying to follow in his father's footsteps for a while. Did not work out for him. And yeah, he spent most of his time as the tax collector in Lewes, a town in southeast England, where he inspected cargoes. And his first writing was actually related, his first kind of long writing was related to his tenure as an excise officer.
I guess the things that people know Payne the best for, though, really almost all Americans will know, well, I hate to say almost all Americans, some Americans will know about the Common Sense pamphlet, and maybe somewhat fewer will know about the Rights of Man. Would you say those are the two things they would be most likely to know about him?
Absolutely. Those are the two.
Okay. So if you wouldn't mind, let's go right to those. So Common Sense, I don't think there's anything wrong with the standard view of this, which is that his pamphlet, because I think George Washington even said that his pamphlet was changing the minds of men. And he was an early supporter of independence, and he made arguments in there in favor of independence. Do you think the standard telling of this is correct?
It's basically correct, though I think that the standard narrative only scratches the surface and doesn't get into some of the philosophical arguments within Common Sense. So just to set the stage and how extreme this was at the time, the First Continental Congress had passed the Olive Branch Petition, which essentially called for a reconciliation with Great Britain. There wasn't many people calling for outright independence in early 1776, but Payne wrote Common Sense at the end of 1775. It was originally going to be called Plain Truth, and basically it had an incredible appeal with regular people. And the reason for that is that Payne, in a deliberate fashion, he decided to use what was called vulgar terminology. So he was using terminology not considered profane, but that would be more colloquial. So what I would compare this to is like construction workers and how they would talk like compared to, say, the business world. But Payne made such arguments as that, you know, this is essentially a constitutional crisis. This is not just a minor kind of extension of tyranny into North America. This is, you know, something worth fighting. And the only recourse for people to have is outright independence through secession. And that word didn't exactly exist back then, but that's what he called for. He said that the current government of Great Britain was not only tyrannical, but illegitimate, established by a bastard Norman in 1066, that being William the Conqueror. So the notion that the Tories were using at the time to say, hey, you know, fealty belongs to the mother country, meaning Great Britain. He said, well, by that logic, you know, Great Britain is a French colony of France established by William the Conqueror. He also called for a declaration of independence, more or less. He called it a declaration for independence, which would not only call for independence, but also try to establish diplomatic relations. That eventually happened. Again, he was basically the only person at the time making these arguments in the press at the time. He also said that this continent needed what he called a continental charter. And our friend Kevin Gutzman has, you know, been on the record many times saying that Americans essentially invented the idea of written constitutions, but Payne was one of the first that ever really proposed this. So yeah, Common Sense struck a chord with the common person. Payne renounced his copyright so it could be disseminated as far and wide as possible. And there's still a lot of debate on how many exact copies it sold, but it absolutely made the mark at a time where nothing could be more extreme than this at the time. It would be like calling for an end to democracy today, right? So.
Yeah. Well, I thought that, you know, your point about renouncing the copyright made me wonder, I guess I could ask Kinsella, Stephen Kinsella, how far back, I'm not asking you to answer this, I don't expect you to know, how far back copyright even goes, you know, that the state could enforce it? How far back does that go, I wonder?
I wonder too. I don't know that for sure, but I know that he also did that in the case of the Rights of Man. And again, both decisions basically guaranteed that, you know, the sales of this were far and beyond almost anything that could exist at the time.
Yeah. And of course, in terms of in case he was interested in his own personal fame, that cause would be greatly advanced, obviously, by the free circulation of Common Sense. I want to skip ahead just for a second because I want to ask something that, and maybe I glided over it. But I could have sworn I read somewhere that later, in the 1790s, you can find Payne advocating for one form or another of a welfare state. Have I imagined that, or did you come across that?
No, it's absolutely true. And I'm so glad you asked this because it gets into the part of Payne that it's not laudatory, right? So Payne, in the second part of the Rights of Man, basically called for the welfare state in germ for the first time in human history. So he called for relief for the poor, relief for the elderly, essentially the underpinnings of the first progressive income tax in Western civilization, essentially, and several other public works projects. So, you know, keep in mind that in that time, Paine had said, you know, England's system of taxation is onerous and it's particularly harmful toward poor people. And that's of no doubt. But Paine really proposed these things about 100 years before, you know, Bismarck ever even put one together for the first time, you know, in Europe. He also called for a proto-UBI scheme that would be assessed via land tax on cultivated land. So like Locke, he believed that all property was kind of given to mankind in the commons. And by combining your labor with those resources, that was property in the first case, right? But where he kind of went away from Locke is he believed that all that property, still a part of it, remains with the entire populace. So on that basis, he proposed for there to be like an annual stipend given to individuals from that. And I hate to say this, but I think Andrew Yang, and I'll never say this about anything else about him, but I think he was right in saying that there is kind of precedent in what Paine said in as far as modern UBI schemes.
Okay. All right. So there is that aspect of Paine. Now, obviously, there are wealthy people who have favored the welfare state. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily Paine's own experiences with money or the lack thereof that was the motivator. And of course, we couldn't know that anyway. But I do secretly wonder if some of his own personal struggles, you know, where to the point where he had to write to friends to see if they would help him out, might have had some influence on this. But of course, we can never know that.
Indeed, I think he does imply that in several ways, if not directly through his actions, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing I love about him, I have to say, is his turns of phrase. I mean, this is not somebody, he doesn't write like William F. Buckley Jr. You know, he writes like Murray Rothbard, you know, not Man, Economy, and State Murray Rothbard, but like Rothbard giving a speech kind of thing. Very, very provocative. So you share a passage where he talks about his reaction to the honorifics we give to people in government. And he thinks this is such an absurdity. You know, they're the right honorable so-and-so and the honorable. And he just thinks it's so weird. Yeah, the honorable plunderer of his country, if that's what you want to call it. I mean, that's great. His punchiness is, to my mind, and the strength of his arguments, to be sure, but that punchiness makes him so memorable.
Absolutely. His radical streak and his irreverent streak are the two most defining characteristics of Paine. And I just want to leave you with an anecdote that kind of shows it. He was basically tried in absentia and sentenced to execution in England for breaking kind of their sedition laws. He was tried for seditious libel against the monarchy because he essentially called for an outright end to it. But as he was departing the country upon the counsel of several friends, including the famous poet William Blake, he wrote to the Home Secretary. Now, the Home Secretary of Britain at the time was involved in law enforcement. And instead of the typical valedictions that you see at the end of 18th century letters, his said, "I am most certainly not your most obedient, humble servant." So if that doesn't show Paine's wit, I don't know what else does.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about that, maybe the first part then of the rights of man before it gets to the other stuff. First of all, what's the context of this work? And then what are the main points he wants to advance?
Yeah, so the context was Europe was swirling with different sensibilities regarding the legitimacy and the efficacy of the French Revolution. So by the time he wrote that, basically the Estates General had been summoned by the king, the storming of the Bastille had happened, the tennis court oath had happened. So for people not familiar with the French Revolution, those were some of the first events that, you know, created a French Republic, essentially. Many people in Europe were of the mind that this is a natural extension of liberty. This is, you know, necessary to bring down this systematic treachery that was monarchy in Paine's mind. And one of Paine's good friends at one time, by the name of Edward Burke, very famous parliamentarian, took issue with this. He said that this threatens the stability that the monarchy in France offered. And not only that, it was filled with bloodshed. The people that basically established themselves as the new National Assembly would act erratically. And eventually this would end up in a military dictatorship. Now, he was actually right about that last part.
Yeah, Edmund Burke was a soothsayer in some ways.
Yeah, but Paine was saying, how could someone so dedicated to liberty as he knew his friend Burke to be for his essential support for the American revolutionaries be so wrong on this? Because to Paine, every person had the right to alter or abolish their government. And, you know, that wouldn't always be easy in every case. But he thought Burke's arguments about the monarchy and the stability, and especially Burke's contention that only the original kind of generation that established the social contract could make such decisions, and all successive generations had to be bound to it. Paine thought this was actually a form of slavery. And not only that, he said that, you know, the violence that occurred in the wake was mostly defensive because the king was trying to galvanize and align different royalist factions around the new National Assembly and try to put an end to it kind of through coercion. And, you know, this is what happens to confront what really is a malignant entity, being the French monarchy. And he actually didn't take that much issue with Louis the 16th. And we can segue into that if you want.
It is interesting to me that Burke writes his Reflections on the Revolution in France before the end of 1790. And so maybe this is also part of why Paine is so incredulous. He's writing at a time when probably the mildest phase of the revolution has occurred. It's certainly we're nowhere near, you know, the terror. We're not near that part, or the September massacres. Like, none of that has happened yet. And yet he's already claiming that this is going to lead to disaster. Yeah, I can imagine some people not being convinced by that and thinking this is a salutary move toward political liberty. And so, I mean, I'm kind of a Burkean on the French Revolution, but he was so far ahead on this that I can understand why a Paine would respond the way he did. Now, as time goes on, though, and Louis XVI is executed, and then the more radical phase comes along, well, how does Paine change along with that, or does he change?
Yeah, it's so interesting. So Paine actually was one of a few people, and he generally aligned with the Girondin faction, which basically included people like Brousseau, Danton, and to a certain extent, his best friend in France, Condorcet. And he had actually pled with the assembly to spare the life of the king. He thought it would be a terrible example for this new republic in Europe, essentially the first one. I know there's the Dutch Republic, but really the first major one to put a king to death. It would really be to the interests of republicanism to show, you know, the vast difference between the brutish nature of monarchy and republicanism, to send him into exile or send him to the United States, actually, I think was entertained by Paine. So Paine's issue is actually that monarchy itself was a systematic issue. It wasn't just Louis XVI. On the contrary, Louis XVI actually had some love for liberty relative to other kings and helped the Americans in our successful revolution, so to speak. So for this, Paine was put in under the crosshairs of the Jacobin administration that rose to power shortly thereafter under Robespierre, Saint-Just, Marat, and others that some of your viewers might know about. And it is for that reason, I believe, that Paine himself ended up being a target of the Reign of Terror.
Yeah. By the way, did he speak French?
No, Paine spoke no French, which is ironic because Paine was made a delegate of Calais, despite speaking no French, because he had become such a celebrity over the success of the Rights of Man. He became a celebrity akin to Benjamin Franklin's fame over there.
Okay. All right. I was wondering about that because I realized in the middle of this conversation that I actually didn't know whether or not he spoke French. All right. But of course, typical American doesn't speak anything but English, right? Even then, right? Even in the old days. So yeah, why don't we continue with and say a little something about his travails in France, because he did rise to great heights, you know, among Americans for his writing. So it is interesting to continue along and see, you know, maybe not the highest points of his life.
Certainly not. So due to Paine's targeting of Marat in publicly, he criticized Marat and also pled for the life of Louis XVI, who Robespierre actually said, you know, Louis must die so the nation might live, right? Famously so. So because of that, he was targeted, stripped of his French citizenship that was an honorary grant to him, and actually thrown into Luxembourg prison. It was a kind of makeshift prison during the Reign of Terror. He stayed there, I believe, about 8 months, suffering, languishing, and almost dying of a fever at one point. And he was only saved from actual execution, which planned to take place, by a jailer's mistake. So you can believe this or not, but both Payne and his good friend, Thomas Cleo Rickman, who also wrote a biography of Payne, have it that a jailer marked an X on the wrong side of a door that in the morning time when it came to pick up the those that would be executed, he was missed in that morning pickup. And that critical mistake allowed him to survive enough weeks for Monroe to come to his defense, press for his citizenship, reversing kind of the ineptitude of Gouverneur Morris, who seemed to not only not try to press for his American citizenship as a basis to release Payne, but seemed to actually revel in the fact that Payne might be punished.
I can understand people feeling that way about Payne, given his pen, right? You know, I mean, if you were on the wrong side of Thomas Paine's pen or your cause, I could imagine you thinking, well, the SOB's getting what he deserves. You shouldn't think that way, but I can certainly imagine some people doing that. Let's say a little something about his views on religion.
Mm.
Now, he does believe in some kind of a benevolent creator, but very, very much of the 18th century watchmaker variety. Is there anything in his background? Not to say that you couldn't just purely intellectually have arguments that you might make, but I wonder, so is there anything in his background that might account for why he took such a dim view of what we call, I hate this stupid expression, quote unquote, organized religion?
Yeah, if there is, it's the fact that he saw the evils of the union of religion and state and what that could mean. In fact, he fought, you know, very much against that in his writings, especially in The Rights of Man. He basically points to many of the American states as an example for the French, saying, hey, look at Virginia, look at what they've done. They've totally divorced religion from the state, and they've been all the better for it. So I think that he believed that that union brought out the worst nature of both in some extent. But other than that, I don't really think so. Now, you're absolutely right about his opinion. He was a deist, a self-professed one. And let me tell you, there were very few self-professed deists in this time in America. The only other one I know of really is Ethan Allen. So yes, he believed in a single benevolent creator, a clockmaker, so to speak, that created the world and left it to kind of develop in its own direction. He believed that his duty was to do well to God's fellow creations, but he denied all the miraculous aspects of Christianity, all the prophecies. He called them hallucinations in no uncertain terms. He basically mocked things like the Immaculate Conception, saying that this is akin to a fairy tale of like an apparition impregnating a virgin that didn't make sense. So all this said, ironically, he wrote the first version of The Age of Reason. It was eventually two parts as a reaction to the Jacobin de-Christianization campaign in France, because most of the Jacobins, with some exceptions, actually Robespierre being an exception, believe that there need to be like this massive de-Christianization effort and that only reason outside of, you know, sacramental things needed to take root. He tried to create the religious cult that supplanted the religious establishment there. Cult of the Supreme Being.
Right, right. The cult of the Supreme Being. Hey. So a guy like Payne, he's radical on religion. He's radical in politics. He has nothing but contempt for hereditary monarchy or any kind of hereditary aspect in government. So then, what does he positively favor if we know what he's against?
Yeah. Well, he grew up in a time where the aristocratic tradition and monarchy was so deeply entrenched that he was mostly against things. But I'll say that he was very much for universal suffrage. He was very much for hard money. In fact, many of your viewers, especially, you know, the very hardcore libertarian ones, would like to know that Payne's book, Dissertations of the First Principles of Government, is essentially a treatise that is just a pro-hard money treatise that should be read by every libertarian. So he was absolutely for that. He was for meritocracy. He believed in rewarding people that did well based upon their own efforts rather than through, you know, hereditary distinctions and privileges and things such as that. And yeah, he was a good friend to many, a bitter foe to others. And, you know, his nature and his opinions, both pro and con anything, basically lost him many of his friends. So he was a unique figure in a unique time. And most biographers say, you know, my subject has to be viewed in the time from which they came. But I say in the book really directly, Payne was a man that far surpassed the time he came from, for better or worse.
What do you think, as a historian now yourself, What does history have to say about Thomas Paine? Why does it matter that he lived?
Well, he rocked the political orthodoxy of three different countries. And I put it in my book like this. I say that we live in the product of Paine's most radical ideas. The idea that there would no longer be a monarchy was so unfathomable and so unheard of, as was the ideal that there just one day wouldn't be slavery in North America. In fact, Paine was an outright abolitionist, one of the most prominent from his time, something that's almost never said about him. He also, as I kind of mentioned before, really believed that any sort of religious establishment had to be disconnected from the state for freedom of conscience to flourish, because ultimately, then you were just a slave to what the state wanted you to believe. So all three of those things are so commonplace today that we don't even think about them. But in Paine's time, his sensibilities on those issues were so out of place. He would have been called an extremist, a radical, like, you know, libertarians are today.
So the book is Thomas Paine, A Lifetime of Radicalism. I've got it linked to tomwoods.com/2243. Before we go, though, I just feel compelled to ask you, because this is such a big project and it consumed 4 years of your life and your spare time, I mean, you work for a living and this consumed your spare time. What can you share with us, especially people who are either authors or have considered writing a book, what the experience itself was like, apart from Paine, just the, well, maybe it was P-A-I-N, but what's it like sitting down, looking at a screen that's blank, and churning out a biography of Thomas Paine?
Well, it was a lot of work, but here would be my advice, is to treat it like a labor of love. Don't do it so many hours a day that you get burned out on it. Make it your leisure activity that doesn't kind of supplant your typical habit, and don't overdo it. But, you know, what it was like is actually just reading all the historiography, essentially. So I read John Keane's book, Craig Nelson's book, David Freeman Hawk's book, Moncure Conway wrote a 19th century biography of Paine. It was a lot of research, and I've read every word that's known to come from his pen, and that's what I think biographers have to do. But I think that there is a real interest in kind of revisionism along the same lines as you talked about in a recent episode, where, you know, I wouldn't discount the good things that are said about Paine that my predecessors have done, but I think that some things were off a little bit. So this is my attempt to, you know, align with the Murray Rothbard strategy of Jeff Dice put in his blurb of my work and present, you know, the revisionist true account of Paine.
Isn't that amazing that you're in a position where you can say, I've read every single thing Thomas Paine ever wrote? And of course, as a biographer, you would need to do that. I'm trying to think. I think it was St. Isidore of Seville who said that anybody who claims to have read all of St. Augustine is a liar. So at least you didn't have to do that. But
yeah. But I'll just say it's much less impressive to read every word of Paine than it would be to say that you've read every word of, say, Jefferson, right, that had thousands of our letters. But yeah, it is kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, and also it gives you the security of knowing there's no way some pretender can show up and say to you, but you've overlooked his argument. And, no, I haven't. I've read it all.
That's right. It's a fun feeling. It's a great feeling to be the master of a specific facet. And I just hope people can, even if they're not obsessed with Paine, they find fault with Paine. I think whatever your disposition, whether you're libertarian or not, people will find something really interesting about Paine in this book, like it or not.
Do we have his correspondence, by the way, or just his published works?
We do. We have very little of his correspondence, though. And we know that he wrote so many more letters, and some of them, what might have been the most interesting, including one letter he wrote to Robespierre, we don't have.
Oh, so, gee, that would be an interesting one to read.
It would, but we only have several hundred, whereas I think Jefferson has like 20,000 letters, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be weird when historians are, you know, are doing the biographies of the past few presidents when everything's email. Presidents don't write, they're not going to be writing physical letters really anymore. And I doubt they're saving these emails. So it's going to be a challenge for historians. Also, I wonder if any of them are keeping diaries the way presidents used to. You could read their diary or whatever. I mean, and it, you know, maybe it was self-serving, but they kept them. Anyway, I'm just speculating about what the future holds. But you had at least the opportunity to study a guy, for one thing, you admire, which would be hard to say for very many American presidents, right? I mean, I think it's safe to say you're an admirer of Paine.
Very safe, though I do take issue with some things we already talked about. But overall, if I saw Payne today, I would shake his hand and congratulate him on a job well done. I think there's more to like about Payne than there is to hate. And some of his radical ideas worked out well. Some of them didn't. But I think many of them were based on the sensibilities that we share. That is, you know, emphasizing individual rights over the state.
Before I let you go, because we were kind of wrapping up a few minutes ago, and then I just kind of revved back up again. Can we finish with saying something about the very end of his life? I mean, what happens? You know, he has the travails in France, but then what? And then how does he meet his demise?
Yeah, well, he spent some additional years in France. Actually, he was eventually given back his legislative seat for a time. And he, believe it or not, he befriended Napoleon. Napoleon thought that a golden statue should be created in every city in the world to Paine's name. He carried the rights of man in his pocket and even involved Paine in a possible scheme to invade England and possibly name Paine one of the administrators of the new Republican government there. Now, Paine devised a invasion of England that called for many swift-moving gunboats, he called them, at one point. And Napoleon actually brought him in front of a council of military commanders during the Napoleonic era. And I don't know exactly why, but in that meeting, Paine said something to the effect that we should abandon this idea that I've kind of laid out in paper with the gunboats and try to establish peace with Britain. And it's not clear why he said that, but after that point, he was persona non grata to Napoleon. Napoleon would never take his advice again. And after Napoleon's ambitions in seizing the power over the Republic and establishing a military dictatorship under the 18 Brumaire coup, Paine essentially called him the greatest charlatan that ever existed. So after that, he did eventually return to America in 1802, where he was a total pariah, not only for his famous schism with George Washington, I alluded to that a little bit earlier, but he felt personally betrayed that Washington did not do more to free him from bondage in French prison. But he befriended Jefferson. He was seen walking hand in hand with him right immediately upon his return. And some of Jefferson's friends did not want this to happen because during the midst of a second great awakening, this was the guy that, you know, had said that Christianity, as it was understood, was a myth, essentially. And nothing could have been more from the reality of most people than that. He did not live in good health and in much wealth for the last of his days. But he did live to give enough of a trust to the Bonnevie children. The Bonnevies were a family that he lived with in France, and he brought Bonnevie's wife over to allow them to start a new life in America. But, you know, he was kind of viewed as an outcast, treated as such. He did maintain friendships with a few people, but some of the biographies have this wrong because he really did have good friends despite many of the animosities amongst the Federalist presses, which we get some of the myths about Paine today.
Paine, by the way, is an example, I think, to people today who are controversialists like myself. I mean, I'm obviously not on Paine's level, but controversialists who find themselves intensely disliked by some people and yet cheered by a great many others. And I know that for some people, it hurts when some people criticize you, and it hurts when people call you a bad person, and it sometimes makes you second-guess yourself. But Paine is an example of somebody who had a genuine impact on history, that history is, you know, took a, you know, let's say a bit of a different turn because he lived. And so just remember, if you are out there accomplishing something, yeah, you will have a lot of people who just can't stand a word you're saying, and they hate your guts. But that doesn't reflect on you necessarily. That doesn't mean you're a bad person. It reflects on them. And it can often mean that you're somebody who is getting things done. I mean, if you were a loser sitting around doing nothing, nobody would bother to attack you. Nobody would have bothered calling Thomas Paine names if all he did all day was sit around and I'm trying to think of what they ate in those days, not potato chips, but you know what I mean? They wouldn't bother if he hadn't been doing something. So take heart, all of you who are out there doing things, but also taking the slings and arrows, that oftentimes that's a sign that you are accomplishing something. So there you go. Dave Benner, thanks so much for your time. So one of these days, if you and I have a few drinks, we'll do a music episode that nobody will listen to.
We could do that. I think our first conversation was about Opeth.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That was so funny that we saw you at that. Not only were you at that concert last year, we saw Opeth in Nashville. Where do you live in Nashville proper?
I do.
Okay. So where Dave lives, we happened to be passing through Nashville. So we went to this concert and we loved it because there was no mask requirement. There was no vaccine requirement. I don't even know if there was a testing. I think we just walked right in and just went to the show. Not only were you there, you were in the same row we were in. So we had to have a drink afterward. And that was when you started. Was that the first time you told me about the Pain Project, or did I know that before then?
I think it actually was, but I think we've known each other for about 8 years. I originally met you in Minnesota, actually. And but that was a fun experience. And hey, there's an overlap Venn diagram between, you know, progressive metal and libertarianism,
yeah,
I guess.
That's right. And I'll say one quick thing. It's nothing to do with anything, but you mentioned Minnesota. That particular event, I remember it distinctly because my flight was canceled. Yeah. And I had to get up to, I don't know if it was it in the Twin Cities? I can't remember for sure.
Yes.
But I was coming from Kansas, or I'd gone to Kansas City at the airport, no flight. So I drove all the way there, and it was a long drive, but I was not going to be deterred. And the neat thing was I got there, and outside the venue, they had like one of those little, not a marquee, it's lit up in lights. And my name was in lights, like tonight, Tom Woods. I thought, well, this must be the place.
It was a great time. And man, that's a legendary story that the people that were involved in that still talk about that experience and having you. I think you talked about Rollback that day. It was great.
Yeah. And I just remember thinking for some reason, I think today probably I would have turned around and gone home and said, sorry, I can't do it. But you know, when I was young and robust, I said, doggone it, I committed to be there and I'm going to drive all the way there. That's exactly what I did. And when I met you and you were known, I don't know if you're still known as Metal Dave. I didn't know anything about any of that. I thought, I don't understand this guy.
I have heard that before. More of a college thing, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what I liked was you were super knowledgeable. The first thing I noticed was, wow, this guy knows a lot about, we were talking about federalism and the states and the union and all that. And you eventually wrote a book on that.
I did. Compact of the Republic, The League of States and the Constitution was my first book, 2014. Very proud of it. It kind of is a defense of the decentralized nature of the American government, which has been totally thrown to the wayside in so many ways, right?
Yeah, no kidding. Anyway, all right, listen, I'm going to let everybody go mercifully here, and I will not share any further stories. But again, congratulations, Dave, and I hope people will pick up Thomas Paine, A Lifetime of Radicalism. Love him or hate him, he's a very important figure. And if you like history, as so many people who listen to this program do, then this book will be right up your alley. So check it out, tomwoods.com/2243. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks. Give me your smackers. I assure that you will like it. Sorry.
All right, everybody, that's our episode for today. Hope you had a nice Thanksgiving. If you're listening to this as it's coming out, we are in Black Friday weekend, the best time of year to join LibertyClassroom.com. Been around for 10 years. It's got staying power and dozens of courses that you can consume on the go, taught by people you can actually trust who are going to tell you the full truth about U.S. history, European history, economics, a whole bunch of stuff. When you see all the courses, you just won't believe it. You'd be like a kid in a candy store. So check it out at libertyclassroom.com, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.